Welcome to the Southside Report. I am Mario Scalise. The regular co-host of the show, Jason Gage in California. What's up, Jace?
Not much. I mean, I prefer to be called the talent on the show, but whatever you got to do to introduce us.
Kellerman.
It's been a frustrating season, to say the least.
Well, yeah. We brought that up 2 weeks ago.
It hasn't changed.
The Sox did go on a four. It was a four-game winning streak. Corrected. Four-game winning streak with the Devil Rays. And then they start off a series with the Royals and lose 8-1. Thanks to a rather poor performance by Jose Contreras. But we're really not getting into the Sox season week to week because at this point, barring a 10-15 game winning streak, and even then you got to question them down the stretch, this season doesn't really mean much. But the happenings off the field are important, and the big one, of course, is Mark Burley. That has not only been a big Chicago story, it's been a big Major League Baseball story, because there's stories and rumors and reports coming from all type of avenues, whether it's ESPN or CNNSI or whatever the case may be, about Mark Burley and the Chicago White Sox negotiating a contract, and those reports are 4 years, $50 million, then the report changed to 4 years, $56 million, but now there's even reports that it all might be gone because of a simple no-trade clause.
It's pretty pathetic. When you think back, last Monday, I had written off the fact that Mark Burley would ever play another game with the White Sox, and I was content with that as a fan, both as a fan and what I consider a little bit of an analyst when it comes to baseball, and especially when it comes to Chicago White Sox. But now, today, you know, by about last Wednesday or Thursday when the rumors broke out, and now today, I was optimistic. I pretty much pictured Mark Burley wearing a White Sox uniform for a good chunk of his career, if not the rest of his career. You can never make prediction of what happens late in a player's career, like when Frank Thomas' situation arose. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the reality is it's very hard to near impossible for a player to stay in one organization for a 15- or 20-year career. But in Burley's case, it looked like he'd have at least half of his years, and the better half of his years, in Chicago. And now, a simple no-trade clause? A simple no-trade clause. And let me put one thing out there. The thing that pisses me off, Morris, about this, is not the fact that they're not willing to do the no-trade clause. Because over in general, I would not be opposed to the Sox backing down from a no-trade clause. But it's when you factor in what Mark Burley has sacrificed in order to stay in Chicago and do what he can to stay in Chicago. Because this is a guy, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind, could get a 6 to 7 year deal worth over $100 million. Right around, or at least $100 million in free agency. And he's taking essentially almost half of that to stay in Chicago. So this is a guy that's going to leave $20 or $30 million on the table, maybe $2 or $3 million a year on the table, and you're going to let a no-trade clause come in the way? Let's be honest. The no-trade clause has to be there because the reason he's taking this deal is to stay in Chicago. So he's going to ensure the fact that if he signs this deal for less money to stay here, then he will in fact stay here. Is there anything to blame Burley about this? The only people to blame are the cheap ass, and I don't like to call Jerry Reinsdorf cheap. But it is the ownership. Not willing. If you're not willing to compete in this market, and you're not willing to go out there and do these type of things, then you should not own a baseball team or a sports franchise. You shouldn't. Maybe we should just move the White Sox to Kansas City where you can accept the fact that you were in a small market. The White Sox are now with right around 3 million in attendance. This is a team that earns revenue. And this is a team that needs to act like it. And I'm not saying you go out and make stupid contracts and sign stupid players like the Chicago Cubs did. But when it comes to re-signing your own at under market value, this is a no-brainer, even if it means putting in a no-trade clause. Get with the reality of the times. You got to do it if you're going to own a baseball franchise.
5 years, the original thought was maybe 5 years, $75 million, probably what Mark Burley would have settled for, what he probably would have been looking for. Now, granted, a team might have went overboard and gone 6-7 years like you said. And at that point, really 5 years, $75 million, I don't think that there's really a pitcher in baseball, well, or a player in baseball who's really worth that much. But in the market that we have right now, yes, but in the market we have right now, unfortunately, 5 years, $75 million for Mark Burley seems pretty fair, as hard as it is to say that. Now, you have a guy like Mark Burley, and if there's probably one pitcher, because for the most part, the Sox theory of not going over 3 years, I understand it because I think there's only a handful of pitchers in baseball that you could really go and give 5-6 years to and be confident that they're going to produce for 5-6 years. And I think Mark Burley is one of those guys because he's a lefty, he's a soft tosser, he's a pitcher. And I think long term, he's a guy who could pitch in his 40s, potentially 42, 43 years old because he's a smart guy. And as he gets older, he's just going to get smarter and smarter and smarter. Now, as far as this 4 year, $56 million thing, is Mark Burley taking a pay cut considering what he could get in the offseason? Yeah. But it's still 4 years, $56 million. It's not like he's taking 4 years, $10 million here. It's not like he's making peanuts. He's still going to make a lot of money. So I don't like to go the whole, well, he's taking a big pay cut. We owe him that. I will say this, though. If he simply asked for a no-trade clause, depending what type of no-trade clause it is, I can't see why the Sox would let this get in the way. Even if you just let the no-trade clause go for 2 years, 3 years. If you're going to give him a 4 year deal, say, you know what, the first 2 years there's a no trade clause. Because maybe Mark Burley's afraid of a situation where, you know what, I'm going to sign and then maybe this offseason they're going to deal me to some team that I don't want to play with, and now I got 4 years that I got to stick with, or 3 years that I got to stick, no, 4 years, I'm sorry, 4 years in some city with some team I don't want to play for. So I understand that, but I'd like to see what type of no trade clause he's actually asking for. If it's a full no trade clause, 4 years, while this shouldn't get in the way, and I think at the end of the day the Sox should probably make that deal, I think you have to be somewhat hesitant to it, because I think you always have to be open to making a trade for trading guys. And if it might turn into a situation where if he invokes he wants a 4 year no trade clause, well, what if in year number 3 and he's trade bait because maybe the Sox retooling just doesn't go well and they're really rebuilding? What if he's saying, you know what, all I want to go to St. Louis? Well, now you kind of tie the Sox hands together. So I'd like to see what type of no trade clause it is. I think they should try to meet halfway on that and maybe do 2 years, or maybe limit it and say, listen, here are 10 teams that we could trade you to. Something along those lines.
Well, what makes it even more ridiculous is you got to factor in the fact that Mark Burley, 2 years into this deal, after two seasons, so for years 3 and 4, will be a 10-5 player, meaning he's going to have a full no trade clause at that point anyway. No, so the White Sox really are pussying out on the first 2 years. Because after that, he's already got that no-trade clause. He's got that 5-10 rights as a player. So this is a joke. And this is an absolute cheap shot at all of the fans of this organization and pretty much anyone. There was absolutely no way. If you went through every single baseball franchise in baseball and asked the GM, would you sign Burley to a 4-year, $56 million deal, they would laugh as they were signing because they know it's a good deal. Is it a guarantee? No, there's no such thing as a guarantee in sports, especially when it comes to a pitcher's arm. But it is a no-brainer. It is a no-brainer, and the White Sox not making this move, and if it in fact doesn't happen because of this, it's an absolute joke, and it's an indication that management and ownership need to step up and make some changes. And this is all saying the fact that if we deal Burley, I really don't have a problem. If you get a good return, it could work out better than signing him. So don't let me tell you that this is going to like handicap the franchise, but this is a bad move. This is a bad PR move. This is a bad baseball move. This is just a bad move.
I don't think the deal is
no. Give him this deal.
I don't think the deal is a no-brainer, but I do think the deal is fair for both sides. And like I said, if they're going to let a no-trade clause, depending what it is, get in the way of it, it is on the Sox fault, especially since they let it get this far. Like you said, you were okay with the White Sox trading Mark Burley, and the reason is because it seems like they were so far apart. So if they just let it stay far apart and they made a trade, fine, no big deal. But when you get the rumors out there that you're in contact, in contract talks, Rick Hahn supposedly travels to Florida to talk with Burley's agent, and you have negotiations going, if you're going to let a simple no trade clause break it down to that point, you do have to question just the whole thinking with the White Sox. Because why? Even if it's for the first 2 years or whatever the case may be, why would they feel like they need to trade him a year from now? It just doesn't make any sense. A guy like Mark Burley, if you're willing to give him 4 years, $56 million, which I think is a fair deal considering he's one guy you could say is going to produce for a long time, why would you want to trade him in a year anyway? He's still going to be relatively young. He's a guy where even if you start rebuilding next year, you could rebuild with him as main component along with John Garland. And it takes us to John Garland.
The sad reality of the Mark Burley situation is going to have a serious impact on the John Garland situation. And don't get me wrong, I love Mark Burley, but John Garland has been the White Sox best pitcher over the last 2.5 seasons, and he's been their best pitcher this season. John Garland has been flat out robbed this year, many games. And Mark Burley's been fantastic this year. So has Javier Vasquez. and we're going to talk about Vasquez a bit later. But this situation, Burley and Garland are close. They are very close in the organization. They want to stay around. Garland would like to stay in Chicago, but I don't think that's going to happen because if ownership's not willing to step up and sign Burley to a below-market contract, then they're sure as hell not going to sign John Garland to a contract. And John Garland's got to be watching this knowing the writing is on the wall. John Garland is going to be gone in this offseason, and it's going to be a big mistake because this team, if they want to compete in the next 1 to 2, 3 years, maybe next year's a little bit pushing it, but in the following 2 or 3 years, then you have to be building your rotation around Mark Burley, John Danks, John Garland, and hope that Gavin Floyd, Gio Gonzalez, Faustino De Los Santos, and whoever you acquire in some of these
good
other
job
deadline
pronouncing.
Moves. Huh?
Good job pronouncing the name.
Oh, I'm good at that. I don't botch names. I create names.
Yeah, but you want to build a team around a rotation, I mean, around Burley and Garland. And I think Garland isn't far off for Burley to where you have to be pretty confident that he's going to be able to go 2-3 years from a health standpoint. And one thing you have to like about Garland is obviously Burley's left-handed, and that's one big advantage he has. Garland has just that natural stuff, and he's learning how to pitch every single year to where he's a guy who he could be even more dominating than a Mark Burley. So while Mark Burley might be the safe signing, a guy like Garland is a guy you really want to keep for the long term, and you're right. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. Now, I don't think Garland's going to be gone because of Burley being gone. I don't think Garland's going to say, you know what, you got rid of Burley, I'm going to leave too. I think if the money's on the table, he's going to take it. But you kind of question if the White Sox are even going to bother with it, because if they're willing to give up a Mark Burley, giving up a John Garland shouldn't be that big of a deal to them either.
And here's my question. I know Ken Williams wants to win, but I want to know this. If you're going to just develop guys and at the point they get good and cost a little bit of money, get rid of them, then really what's going to happen? Because I want to know a team in the last 5 or 10 years that's won the World Series without having veteran arms. Isn't that what got the White Sox where they were? Yes. Now, you could tell me a team had just a super dominant offense, and every once in a great while, a team with a dominant offense and terrible pitching staff will win the World Series. But most of the time, it's a team with a veteran rotation with good arms that wins. The Detroit Tigers made it to the World Series with some young arms, but they also had Kenny Rogers in there leading them, the veteran arm, and they still fell short because of those young shortcomings.
I don't think Kenny Williams is expecting the Sox to win a rotation with a guy like Gavin Floyd making $500,000. I think he is willing to spend, but I think he has a limit. And I'm not even going to say it's Jerry Reinsdorf. I mean, I think Kenny Williams made it very clear this last offseason that he wasn't happy with the way the Gilmesh is, although he's actually produced fairly well this year. Average pitchers are getting these big contracts, and he wasn't too happy with it. So I think Kenny Williams, just on a personal level, on an individual level, he doesn't like the way the contracts are given out. And he gave a contract to Javier Vasquez, he gave a contract to John Garland, he gave a contract to Jose Contreras. I think he's willing to go into that $8 to $10-12 million range. I think he's just hesitant to go $14-15 million unless you're an elite pitcher. And you could even say that Mark Burley potentially could be an elite pitcher in the long term. So I don't think Williams is trying to go out there and build a rotation of Gavin Floyd's and John Danks, and as soon as they're looking for $5-6 million, he's going to dump them.
Well, then I should just call Ken Williams stupid, because he is building the rotation on the two guys that are over 30 as opposed to the two guys under 30. And that's talking about Mark Burley and John Garland. And let me say, I do not think the fact that they signed Javier Vasquez or Jose Contreras to extensions was a bad move.
No.
I love the Javier Vasquez signing. Loved it at the time, and I love it now. And I think it's a good move. And I don't think that money is why they can't give Burley money.
No.
I don't think that at all.
To do
I think
with
they
money.
Can give Burley
it's
money because...
Yeah, I don't
because
think
I think they can move Jose Contreras, and they need to move Jose Contreras.
I don't think
don't
it's a money thing,
that.
And then that's why I think what you were saying before with the whole, you kind of hinted that the Sox are being cheap. I don't think it is a money thing at all. I think it's just what do they feel a pitcher is worth. And Williams seems like he's very hesitant to go and follow the lead of all these other teams who are giving out big contracts. So I think that's where it comes from. I think Williams just hesitant to give out a big deal, but. You got a guy who you've had in your organization for a few years now. You drafted him. You had him go through your system. He developed into one of the better pitchers in the American League, one of the better pitchers in baseball. You got to do what you can, and you shouldn't let, simply as we said over and over, you should not let a no-trade clause get in the way. Now, if that does break down, and if he is back in the market, does his value at all drop? Not value. Do what the Sox get for him drop at all, considering that all these contract talks kind of fell, meaning that they have to trade him? Because if these contracts fall apart right now, if these contracts fall apart, let's say tomorrow Kenny Williams says, you know what, contracts are off, 99.9% chance he's not signing with this team in the offseason. That's it. The negotiations are over, which means that the Sox, if they're looking for value with them in a trade, they have to make that trade, right? Or do they take a chance on compensation picks?
I think you have to know that in the end, you can get upper echelon talent with compensation picks, so you cannot be forced into making a deal. If the right offer does not come around from Mark Burley, you do not trade Mark Burley. You take the draft picks and you tell Mark Burley, let's say negotiations break down, you say, Mark, we still want to go at it again this offseason and try to keep you here. You got to at least try. You cannot give up with a guy like Mark Burley, mm-hmm. with the caliber of player he's been in this organization, with the respect both Burley and the White Sox have for each other. You cannot let that guy buy. And you cannot discount the fact that even if negotiations don't go down today, that if Burley was traded, that he could still come back to Chicago. The chances dwindle by a large percentage, but he could still come back because maybe Jerry Reinsdorf, maybe Ken Williams – or more, they see what happens with that Burley, and they're saying, hey, we cleared up Jose Contreras, Jermaine Dye, and they feel more comfortable about adding a little bit more payroll.
But here's the thing, and let's say you're Mark Burley, and let's say you go, okay, I'm willing to take a 4 years, $56 million deal with a no-trade clause. And they say, no, we don't want to do no-trade clause. Contracts break off. When that offseason comes, if the Sox come to you saying, okay, we'll do 4 years, $56 million, we'll give you the no-trade clause, will you take the deal at that point? Because I'm thinking most players would say, you know what, the offer was there, I could get a lot more money now, too late.
No, the Sox would have to offer more money.
Exactly. And that's why I don't think, that's why I think that it wouldn't happen. I think this would be their opportunity if they do plan on keeping him, you know, signing him to a contract extension. I think it happened now. And I think the only reason... if they didn't do any negotiations right now and they waited to the offseason, I think a 4 years, $56 million deal may have worked. It may have worked. But considering they initiated the talks now and it broke down, I think that's it. Now, unless they get this deal done in the next few weeks prior to July 31st, he is not returning to the White Sox. I would say that just very confidently and like I said, 99.9% chance he's not coming back if these contracts, as of, you know, these contracts that have been going on for the last week, break down completely.
I actually think you're dead wrong on this stance, because this was the only time that there could be negotiations. Mark Burley knew that the odds on bet he was going to be traded within the next 5 to 10 days. So he basically stepped up and opened up talks because the camps had been quiet.
And if the Sox are going to end those talks because of a no trade clause, I could see Mark Burley saying, "You know what? Screw you guys. If you're gonna not want to sign me because of no trade clause, I'm walking." Because there's no, you said in the beginning of the show, Mark Burley might even be able to command a 6-year deal, which is something the Sox will never do. And he's probably going to be able to command a lot of money, $80 million maybe, who knows. So there's no way the Sox are going to go out there and be able to compete with any team that's going to throw him money in the offseason. There's no way. So I think that's what it's going to come down to. I think Burley's going to go into the offseason, and he's going to be listening to a lot of offers, and at that point the Sox are going to have to try to match an offer, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Oh, definitely. The odds are a lot less, but I do not consider it an impossible outcome or situation. Okay. Because I also think Ken Williams and Reinsdorf, you don't know how these talks break off. If they break off and there's still some positive light, and now if it's the White Sox going, nope, we can't do it, it's done, it's over, fine. But if it's the White Sox and Burley going, hey, we really respect what you did, we got to really debate about this, we're really adamant against and to no trade clause, but we love you, and we'd like to make a more competitive offer later on, potentially. And they kind of leave that open, but we also know that as an organization, we got to move forward and get some more talent. So if you come back, we're going to be more set to win long term. If you could maybe phrase it, maybe you have a possibility, albeit a very, very slim one. And yes, I am an optimist in this situation. And part of it is because I love Mark Burley. He is my favorite player on the White Sox when it comes to a pitcher, him and John Garland. I've kind of grown. We've gotten to watch them develop, and we've gotten to see them turn into aces. Well, maybe not aces, but front of the line rotation guys. And it's you definitely get attached to them. Mm-hmm. But if you get a great offer, I have no problem moving Mark Burley. I only have a problem because now he's willing to sign a very affordable deal, and I like pitching. I like young pitching, And Burley's 28 years old, and he's got a lot of years left.
I think that's fair enough. Let's stick with the rotation. We have Jose Contreras this week, this past week. Talks, of course, there's been rumors talking about him possibly having interest from the New York Mets. And he, of course, has a no-trade clause, and there was discussions on whether he would waive that no-trade clause. And Jose Contreras simply said he really, really, really wants to stay. But if the Sox came to him and said, we have a deal for you to go to New York Mets or wherever the case may be, we want you to waive the no-trade clause, he would waive it for the simple fact is that he figures, well, if you're willing to trade me, that means you don't want me. Why would I want to stay here? Now, with that said, once again, he says he really wants to stay here, but he would waive that no-trade clause. That pretty much means a deal's got to be done. Because I like Jose Contreras. I mean, I wouldn't say that I would build a rotation around him, but I do like him. I do think he's a solid pitcher, and I do think he could be productive for you next year. I'm not sure how healthy he would be, but I do think he could be productive. However, if you have the opportunity, especially come down the stretch, to trade him to a New York Mets, a contending team, or trade him to a team that really needs an arm, I think you have to pull that deal. Because you might be able to get, considering the talent of a Jose Contreras compared to the talent of a Mark Burley, you might be able to get pretty damn close to the same value.
There's no doubt about it. And I know the thing with Contreras is it all depends on what a team thinks about Jose Contreras. They have to be scared of the fact that his fastball is no longer popping into the mid-90s. It is really 89 to 90 mile an hour, and it's made him a little bit less effective. However, he's going to probably be going to the National League.
Yes.
And from what
that's
my
huge.
And I have actual some sources in the Dodgers organization that have said the Dodgers are interested in him. Now, that's all I have. I don't have any, like, trade or names that are being thrown about, anything along those lines. But you can bet your butt the Dodgers, who have lost Jason Schmidt for the season, will consider a deal for a guy like Contreras, and he should pitch well in a place like Dodger Stadium, especially moving to the National League. Mm-hmm. You can bet your butt the New York Mets, if Pedro Martinez doesn't come to fruition, and he's supposed to be potentially back in July, then you look at a guy like Contreras. Although Jeff Maine has been, or John Maine has been fantastic for the Mets, there's no way you can count El Duque continuing to pitch as well as he has. And Tom Glavine's actually struggled as of late. So, I mean, that rotation is still up in air. And as long as Atlanta's close, the Mets have to feel some pressure.
Contreras is signed, I believe, through 2008, or is it 2009?
2009. He's got 2 years left, and this is a no-brainer. The White Sox need to move Jose Contreras, and I honestly don't care what you get in return for him, because it's more important to get rid of his contract. Because that frees up options to fill other holes. And it also opens up a rotation spot for Gavin Floyd,
I think,
who
it's
needs
big,
to be at the major league level right now.
I think it's big that you do get something for him. Now, don't get me wrong. If somebody goes up to the White Sox and they offer him a crap deal for Jose Contreras, I think you got to pull back, because you do have to realize that while maybe he's not as productive as he used to be, maybe he doesn't have a bright future ahead of him, the guy is still a productive pitcher, and if he goes to the National League, whether it's the Mets or the Dodgers or whatever, the fact that he's got the different arm deliveries, he's never been into the National League before, he is going to be very, very productive, at least you would think, for maybe a year worth of time. So if they make a trade to the National League, the National League team is going to get some production out of him. So I think the Sox should expect something in return. So I wouldn't say try to get anything for him, because while I do think maybe they should try to lose that contract, I don't think they should lose it at all costs. So they should definitely try to get some good talent, some major league talent that could produce as a starter. Don't try to get a bench player or a possible prospect. Get a guy who could be a starter for you, or at least be given a chance to start in the next year or so. Now.
Well, first off, they should not be trading Jose Contreras for a starting pitching prospect. They need to get outfield help.
No, I'm talking about starting.
The New York Mets and
position
Dodgers have it.
Position
and
players.
It would be stupid not to move Jose Contreras. The White Sox will pay and pay dearly if they do not move him now, because he may very well be unmovable in 2008, and he could be in 2009 as well, because he is over 40 years old. There's no doubt about it. And
I understand, but
you got to move him, and hopefully they get value for him. Hopefully,
but
there's
value
out there.
What if somebody offers you a fringe double-A prospect? You're going to make that move?
Yes, because that $20 million over 2 years of rebuilding is more valuable. You throw that money into the draft. You throw that money into multiple free agents, because this team has a lot more holes, and Gavin Floyd and his 95-mile-an-hour fastball and big curveball need to be up in the majors, getting development now, and him filling that spot. Plus, this move may just give you the opportunity to go after another big-name guy like an Ichiro Suzuki or someone else that fills a bigger need, because starting pitching is not the biggest need in Chicago. Outfield help and the bullpen are, and especially fixing that lineup and getting some athletes in there. And $20 million to Contreras, 20 plus over the next 2 years, is just bad baseball decisions.
All I am saying is to test the waters. Test things out. See what you could do. All and what I'm saying is that if the LA Dodgers call Kenny Williams tomorrow and they have a deal for some fringe player, don't just say yes just because you want to dump him. See how it is. Now, if you want to make that deal July 30th and get nothing for him, that's fine because you want to dump his contract. But you have now a month. Try to get what as much as you possibly can for him. And then at last minute, if there's nothing there and no team has interest and a Dodgers or a Mets, whatever, come up with some crappy deal, if you want to trade him at that point, fine. But I think you have to at least go out there and try to find a couple teams that want him, let them fight for each other, and try to get some decent player for him or a couple decent players for him. Okay? That's it. No more about that.
I just want to say, there if you go. Listen to me, there that is what I was saying. I was saying
get anything
that
for him.
July 31st, you take anything for him.
Oh, okay, okay. July 31st. I heard
I
get
said
anything.
You go – did you not hear me? I said you go and try to get that upper echelon prospect. But if no team's willing to offer it by July 31st, well, in the next couple of weeks, if you're not getting any fielders for it, then you got to take the lesser offer to get rid of him. But you okay. first, obviously, for, you first go out and try to get as much talent as you can.
For the record,
like
I didn't,
any situation.
I didn't hear you originally say that. So if you did – it'll be edited post-show. Now, let's get into a break. How about that?
Yeah,
we go to a break. We come back. We're going to get into Mr. Jermaine Dye, who's kind of on the DL, but not really. It's kind of weird. You got Iguchi, who you claim has to be gone via because of the reason of Richard playing pretty productive down there. And we have to get into Javier Vasquez because a little venting on that end. Yes. We'll be right back.
And I want to do one positive because I want to talk about Paul Konerko. We got to have a positive in the show, and Paul Konerko has been a positive as of. So we'll be back.
And we're back to the show. Segment number two, which is a rarity for us, but we got into a little bit of an argument, apparently, since Jason got offended by my words, so he had to go cool off and do a number one. Now, we're gonna get into some position players, namely Jermaine Dye, like we said right before the break. He's kind of been on the DL, although he's still on the 25-man roster, and the reason, in the words of Jason Gage, is because... actually, in the words of the White Sox, is because they don't have anyone that they could call up to replace him. Which
and
is...
Jason Gage says that's bullshit. Bullshit. Ryan Sweeney should be playing. Because if Jermaine Dye ain't capable of playing, and we know the White Sox aren't capable of winning, or at least, you know, winning anything important, then you got to play Ryan Sweeney. The guy's got his average up 30 points over the last couple weeks down in Charlotte. He made some, you know, he did some good things when he was up here earlier on in the season. The White Sox apparently love him. So he needs to be up here. He needs to be. So I want to know why he isn't, because if Jermaine Dye is not capable of playing, and I got to tell you, if they wanted to tell Jermaine Dye that he's not capable, that even though he's not healthy, they're not going to put anyone on the roster because no one else is good enough, no one else is ready, that's bullshit. You should not say those type of things, because that slams every single individual that's either not starting on the Chicago White Sox right now in that outfield, or down in the minor leagues at all capable of coming up. That is just bad.
See,
why do that?
Maybe you read something different than I did, but I got the impression that it was Jermaine Dye who didn't want to go in the DL, because Azeguin was actually a little bit upset with them because of the fact that if you're not ready to play, you know, because they actually were going to put him in the lineup, and Jermaine Dye says, I'm not ready. So the game basically comes back, well, if you're not ready, you should be on the DL. So, at least from Azeguin's standpoint, he's had no problem trying to put Jermaine Dye in the DL, but Jermaine Dye doesn't want to go in the DL, yet he's not ready to play. So, I don't know if I can necessarily fully say that the White Sox openly said that. I don't know if I buy into all that.
This was the initial stance up until basically Friday when Jermaine Dye couldn't suit up. And at that point, Ozzy said, I can't wait any longer, because they were more than happy to wait 7 or 8 days, but they're
yes.
not going to wait the full 15.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, but for the first 8 days, they obviously decided that a team without Jermaine Dye was perfectly fine. That basically having 24 players was better, just the fact that you could maybe have Jermaine Dye for five games during that 15-day deal.
Not like the Sox are in any situation where they're going to do anything anyway. And yeah, Ryan Sweeney could get some playing time, but if Jermaine Dye was going to come back in 6-7 days, you know Jermaine Dye is going to go to right field. You know he's going to play in right field because he's trade bait. And on the other side of the field, you have more possible trade bait in Scott Pezzetti. So the fact is, Ryan Sweeney would have came up, and you know what? Who knows how much he would have played anyway. So if he's doing good in AAA, let him stay there. Now, if they would have decided he would have been on the deal from the beginning, I understand that. But the fact that they waited, they thought he might have been back in 5-6 days or 7 days, I don't think that's that big of a deal.
Well, now,
granted, he should probably still go on the DL, and they should probably make it retroactive to today for all I care. Put him on the DL, make sure he gets healthy so he could come back, put in a good week or two, and then maybe he could be traded at that point. Although now we're approaching July, so I'm not sure how it might be kind of risky at this point.
Right now, I wonder if Jermaine Dye has any trade value. The only way I could have considered why they left him on the active roster is if they had some very tempting trade talks going on, and they didn't want to put him on the DL because at that point they couldn't trade him. So they were figuring, okay, we keep him off the DL, we'll work a trade, we'll make that trade, and then the other team that gets him will eventually can either DL him retroactively or play him.
Or they were just trying to play off that he wasn't really that hurt and it was just a day-to-day thing. And maybe that's why. Maybe that's why they kept him off the DL, saying, you know what, he's going to play tomorrow. And eventually they say, okay, you're going to play tomorrow, and Dye says, well, I'm not ready. That could have been it too. Maybe they were just trying to hold him off to try to pull off a trade. And they felt maybe a stint on the DL may have lowered his trade value. But it seems like, yeah, his value has probably dropped because of his injury. And if he does go in the DL and if he does come back, you wonder, does Jermaine Dye have to produce it all?
Yes. Unfortunately, he does. And the only way he's going to produce, and this is what the White Sox need to do, as far as I'm concerned, unless they already have some pretty good offers out there on the table, they need to DL him. Wait till July 7th, 8th, whatever it takes for him to be fully 100%, and then you bring him back, and you figure he's got 2 weeks to play. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks to get – he's got about a week to get That's back, it. A week to get back, and then 2 weeks of playing after he's had a week back. So basically you have that, and then you have a window to trade him. If you don't have the value, do not make a trade because he still should be signed to a deal by someone like the Rangers because teams are going to take him next year knowing that he's going to be 100%. You know, going into next season.
Oh, yeah.
You're still going to get two compensated.
There's guys much worse than him who have starting major league jobs. So Jermaine Dye is definitely a possibility, even if he's got to make a shift to first base or something along those lines. So he's going to have some suitors in the offseason.
So the key is, if you get a deal from, let's hypothetically say the LA Dodgers, because I think we should do a deal with the Dodgers and the Mets. One for a pitcher, one for a for Dye, and possibly the other for Burley. I think all deals should go through those two places, most likely.
You know, unless
Boston steps up or Atlanta offers someone else.
Here's something to think about, and it kind of ties into the whole Mark Burley thing. Okay, you look at Jose Contreras, and as you said, he may not have much value because he is 40. Although it says 35, he's 40. He's not exactly doing productive. His last start, he got knocked around by the Kansas City Royals. So but there's a possibility that they could get very little offers for him. There's a possibility they could get very few offers for Jermaine Dye. Tadi Taguchi, being a second baseman and producing decent numbers, may not get a lot in return anyway. So there's not many guys on his team, considering how many holes the Sox have, because they have plenty of holes from the offensive standpoint, from the outfield standpoint. You could even go into the infield and the bullpen. If they can't get much for Dye, if they can't get much for Contreras, if they can't get much for Noguchi, at that point, do they maybe just have to trade Burley just because they could get something for him? Or do they just make those trades, get decent stuff in return, and now they're relying purely on the free agent market this offseason?
Well, I definitely think they will probably end up doing that. I think in the case of
it could be scary.
Burley, I want to be a realist here, and I think in the case of Burley and Contreras, you'll get at least, I think in Burley's case, you'll get two impact guys. You may not get the number one, two, and three prospects in the system, but you should get two to three very good prospects, probably made near major league ready, that should get you some athleticism. You may not get the number one prospect in their organization, but you got to push for it. You really do. And I think when push comes to shoves and you have the Boston Red Sox of the world, the New York Yankees of the world, the Atlanta Braves of the world, the Milwaukee Brewers of the world, you know, surprisingly to say, the LA Dodgers of the world, maybe the San Diego Padres of the world, you don't know. All pushing for that deal, maybe the St. Louis Cardinals come in, that you're going to get teams to go in there and offer something of good value for Burley. Maybe not as much as if he was signed to a deal, but the reality is you should get something good for him, and Jose Contreras should get something good. You should be able to get one or two impact players, or potentially impact prospects, I should say. And then in the case of Iguchi, you're right, there's definitely lesser value there, and I still think there's value to die. I still think the ability to get either the draft picks, which can be impact guys just later on down the road, or you can get maybe the Dodgers offer a Wilson Bedemit and a guy like Kemp. Kemp has some attitude issues, but he's got a lot of talent. And as a prospect, he would be an athlete, and he would really make the Sox a lot better long-term. And a guy like Bedemit can play shortstop, he can play second, he can play third, and he's shown in limited major league playing time that he can hit for a lot of power, and he's got a lot of talent, even though he's struggling a bit with the Dodgers right now, but he's still only 25, 26 years old, and it really makes sense because he fills a hole. He could replace, you know, a guy like Juan Uribe and give you some offense there. He could maybe play second base where Tadahito Iguchi or Danny Ricard could play, you know? You have those options. And that's a deal that I think you make over the the draft picks.
Speaking of Ricard, he's been a pleasant surprise, considering that trade was a rather small trade, kind of not really talked about much, and he's actually been producing pretty well down in the minor leagues and looks like an actual possibility to be maybe a starting second baseman.
Yeah, and the White Sox have actually played him at shortstop. He's got the natural ability to be a shortstop. The problem is he makes a lot of bonehead decisions, errant throws, and those are kind of the reasons they moved him over to second. But the Sox have actually used him a bit at shortstop, and I think they're going to play him there, and they're going to see what they got with him because this guy's got some tools. He's got some pop. He's got some speed, and he has some focus issues. You know, maybe he has a little D'Angelo Jimenez. Maybe he has a little Juan Uribe in him. But the reality is he's got talent, and he's in AAA, and Tadahito Iguchi is gone. There is no way he helps the White Sox.
No.
Maybe he helps a veteran team down in the lineup, you know, with some scrappiness, but he really doesn't have many more productive years left.
No, I think the reason he doesn't fit with the Sox is because they're such an old team and he kind of just adds to it. And if he was with an athletic team, and you kind of have him at second base just as kind of that veteran, that reliable guy. Even if you bat him second, if you have a nice guy in front of him, a good leadoff hitter in front of him, and he's just kind of that complimentary player who does some little things. And once again, he's old, but if he's on the right team, a semi-young athletic team, I think he could be a productive player. But on the Sox right now, no, he doesn't have much of a future. You can't really even think about bringing him back next year. Although now when you talk about Ricard, if, let's say, he's a possibility, because it's not easy to just go out there and grab any shortstop you want. And if Juan Uribe is done, and if his career with the Sox is over, which it seems like it is just based on his last couple of years, do you want to have a Danny Ricard at shortstop and go through the growing pains that will surely come from it? Because he's going to be making a ton of mistakes. Now, it might work out down the road, but do you want to go through those growing pains at the shortstop position?
Well, I think it all depends on what the ball club looks like. But I think this year you do. I think that's why you have to, regardless of the return, move Tadahito Iguchi. And I like Tadahito Iguchi. I respect everything he did for the White Sox. But him playing another 2 months
doesn't help the White Sox. He's slowing down. He's getting up there, and he looks like he's definitely on the down end of his career. There's no doubt about that. And yeah, maybe what they should do is bring up a Ricard, have him play. He could even play a little bit of second base too, play a little bit of second base, a little bit of shortstop to try to find his spot. So you know what? See what works best for him. If he looks like he's going to second base and he looks like he really has it down pat, why not? It's not like they have set options there anywhere. Granted, it's probably easier to find a second baseman. If he looks like he could be a very, very good second baseman, that might be something you do, and then you deal with the shortstop situation in the offseason, maybe via trade or whatever the case may be. Now, this kind of goes back into the rotation, and this is just some venting I got to do, because I've seen over the past 2-3 weeks, a handful of posts on Sox Talk referring to Javier Vasquez, and these are people who don't particularly like Javier Vasquez and haven't really liked him since day one, and there's maybe some validity to it, but I've heard a lot of comments about that trade, which basically was Javier Vasquez, when you're looking at now, Javier Vasquez for Chris Young. And Chris Young obviously was a top prospect to the Sox, and the Sox at the time had four when you consider him, Brian Anderson, Ryan Sweeney, and Jerry Owens. They had four reasonable prospects.
Do not count Jerry Owens in that group.
He's at the I'm saying at the time he was at the bottom of the list as a reasonable prospect.
He was not a legitimate major league prospect, not a starting prospect. Ryan Sweeney, Brian Anderson, Chris Young. And in the order, it was Chris Young, Brian Anderson, Ryan Sweeney, and you could flip-flop.
He's okay, Jerry Owens is a distant fourth.
I do not want to mention Jerry Owens.
A distant fourth?
I don't want you to do so.
Okay, fine. No. Okay, fine. They had three outfielders. They figured they could trade one of them. They ended up trading him. He's with the Diamondbacks right now. And I got the impression from the reaction of Sox talkers that Chris Young was doing very, very good. And I haven't really seen him. So, obviously, what you see as you watch the game, you might see something different. But just looked at his numbers, and this year and last year, his numbers have been very, 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 very average, if that. And when I look at the situation and you say, okay, here you have this guy who was a top prospect who is not really producing at the major league level. He's doing okay, but he's not showing clear signs of being a star or being a very productive starting player. And then you have Javier Vasquez, who's a 200-inning pitcher, could get you 13 to 15 wins. While I'm not a big strikeout guy, he's a strikeout pitcher on a team that's not really loaded with strikeout pitchers. What's wrong with that?
You really cannot slam this deal from a White Sox perspective.
No, you can't.
Maybe Chris. Now, this could go down because I want to point out that Chris Young is one of the most talented young ball players in baseball. Maybe this deal goes down because he has the tools to be a 40-40 guy. And he's shown a lot with his peripherals that he's got a lot of power, and it's been shown at the major league level. He plays plus defense out in center field. He can be a game-changing player. So there's some reason, you know, that this could, 10 years down the road, turn out to be a horrible deal because of how good Chris Young is for a long time. But Javier Vasquez is a very good pitcher. He's an above-average pitcher.
You know,
sign him an affordable deal. And you really can't slam the move because of that.
Yeah, when you look at the market today, and everyone talks about starting pitching, and that's why you give Burley 4 years, $56 million, because he's a good pitcher, and there's not many pitchers out there, and that's why when a guy like Barry Zito goes into the market, he gets a 7-year deal, because why? Well, there's not many starting pitchers. Well, you have a starting pitcher who's going to give you, like I said, 200 innings, and he's done that for plenty of years. I think I saw the other day, since 2001, he is third in the major leagues in strikeouts. Once again, I'm not a big strikeout guy, but the simple fact is he is behind Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling and ahead of Yoan Santana in strikeouts since 2001. So that alone says this guy is a quality pitcher. And when you have a quality pitcher who at any given moment could be a number three pitcher, number two pitcher for a team in certain stretches, why would you get a little bit all tied up and get a little bit upset over the fact that Chris Young, a prospect and a possibility to be very good player, being on another team? I don't understand that. Yes, 5 years down the road, it could bite them in the... Actually, no. 5 years down the road, Chris Young could be a very good player. But as of right now, it's a possibility. You know what you're getting from Javier Vasquez. You don't know what Chris Young is going to be in the future. So at this point, you can't be upset at this deal. Because right now, would that trade look any different for the Sox? If Chris Young was in center field right now for the Sox playing in the American League, would it look any different? Would the Sox be in a better situation right now? They would at this point. They would have four starting pitchers. Who would be their fifth starter right now? Gavin Floyd. How would he produce at the major league level? And at this point, would you be willing to trade Jose Contreras? How valuable does Jose Contreras become to your team? Now, when the market comes up to this offseason, do you have to then sign a guy to $15-16 million a year on top of a Mark Burley? So, yeah, you know what? Some people could say that Chris Young is going to be a great player, but the fact is that Sox are getting production out of Javier Vasquez and will get production out of Javier Vasquez for a couple of years.
You also, playing devil's advocate a bit, have to remember one reason so many people were frustrated with the trade, and that's that it wasn't a need trade. This was a team that had four starting pitchers and Brandon McCarthy.
Yeah.
And let's remember what Brandon McCarthy was before he went into that
bullpen. The plan was for him to be the fifth starter. And getting Javier Vasquez stop that plan from happening, and it gave him a lot of depth in that starting position, the starting rotation. Where, and we talked about this. I think we talked about this when 2006 last year. The whole point of they did it is they figured, you know what, we have a guy in waiting the wings. Where if any pitcher got hurt, Brandon McCarthy was going to step in. Well, the guys were struggling, and Brandon McCarthy never stepped in. So they definitely dropped the ball in that end.
Let's put it this way: it was depth the White Sox never took advantage of.
No, they didn't. They didn't.
And that was that. And Chris Young, he could have potentially helped, because at least he gives you an athlete. So I think if you want to potentially knock the deal, you can't do it from a talent-for-talent standpoint of Chris Young for Javier Vasquez. Because if you went to any team and you put the numbers next to each other, people were going to be like, hey, I would have no problem with Javier Vasquez. A lot of teams have been like, hey, I'd make that deal every day.
So you got to consider that. If you were to take a guess and you were to go into the free agent market every single year, and you were to take position players and starting pitchers, what would be the ratio of quality available players out there?
Either way.
What's that?
It's slim either way, but there's usually more position players than there are
starting
pitchers.
I'm saying if you're taking a starting pitcher, a quality starting pitcher, you might have about, for every starting pitcher you have, you might have about 2-3 options on a position player. So that starting pitcher is going to be more valuable, and really it's been for much of baseball history it's been that way. Starting pitching more valuable. So when you have a guy like Javier Vasquez and you have a guy like Chris Young, that starting pitcher, it has to be pretty enticing to go after.
And that starting pitcher, if traded today, could get you the number one prospect, probably the number one, two, maybe even number three prospect from the New York Mets. Because he probably has the most trade value of any starting pitcher in the rotation next to John Garland. Because John Garland could give you a ransom.
There's no doubt about that. Now, it all depends what people look, how people look at a John Garland, because he's not really out there a lot. When you throw Mark Burley and John Garland next together, I would bet a lot of people would pick Mark Burley every day of the week when their numbers really aren't that far off as far as what they're going to produce on the field.
Yeah, Caleb's, the poster at SoxDoc, put up a nice little projection since 2005, and going through, I mean, it's like WHIP is like 1.2. Let's say it's hypothetically 1.22, and the other ones is 1.24. It's like every single number is so identical.
For
between Garland and Burley since 2005.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't even know who the difference, you couldn't even tell the difference.
But if you were to go and you were to ask just a random baseball person, Mark Burley, John Garland, you put them together, maybe not a baseball person, maybe like a casual fan or maybe a fan of another team.
Say Mark Burley.
They're going to say Mark Burley. He's the one who's out there a little bit more. Because he's a lefty pitcher. He's got
most people would
he's
still
got
say
that
Mark
charisma
Burley,
to
but
it.
It's
John
close.
Garland is a pretty boring player.
And I kind of want to look back at the deal that could have been with John Garland. The Willie Taveras, maybe. Taveras is doing pretty good. Jason Hurst, the pitching prospect in Colorado, looking decent. But the guy that broke up that deal, Hunter Pence, had Ken Williams made that deal, the Sox would have had Hunter Pence. That would have looked very good in Chicago right now, because Hunter Pence looks like the real deal. I don't know how much you follow the National League, but this is a rookie that's hitting about .380 with power, doubles, plays defense. He's looking very, very good. So hypothetically, and I'm pointing out the fact that, John Garland has a lot of trade value. So if the White Sox really want to get creative and really want to go on a 2 or 3 year down the road Florida Marlins type rebuilding prospect or chances, they have the opportunities to do so by moving some of these type of guys, the John Garlands of the world. And the one guy that I think quietly should get shopped more than anyone else, because I think we've already listed off that if Mark Burley's not going to sign, Mark Burley, Jose Contreras. Mark Burley, Jose Contreras.
Jim Thome.
Yes. I heard whispering, but there's actually one other name. Before we get into Jim Thome, because I think Jim Thome is actually a no-brainer. But the guy that should be quietly shopped is Bobby Jenks. Because out of every single player on the Chicago White Sox, no one has more value than Bobby Jenks. And then you have to ask yourself,
when you're
how
talking
much value
down the stretch,
does a closure really have?
If you have
how
a team,
value?
If you have a team that even has a closer at this point, to add a Bobby Jenks to your bullpen for any team, bullpen gets more and more important every single year. And when you're getting down the stretch into the playoffs, to add a Bobby Jenks, whether you have a closer or not, would be huge. And if you were to throw him out there, Jesus Christ, I can't see a contender not expressing some interest in him.
More importantly, let's just look at the Atlanta Braves. They need a closer. You think Bob Wilkerman's a closer? No. What about the Cleveland Indians? I know you hate dealing with rivals, But do you think the Cleveland Indians are happy with their closer?
Bobby Jaques for Grady Sizemore.
Well, Steve Stone said it would be a no-brainer and the Cleveland Indians would do it in a heartbeat. And let me tell you, if that's the case, I will go and I'll kiss Ken Williams on the lips because that would be such a great trade. Oh, my God, to have Grady Sizemore in center field for the next 10 years. But I'm saying you could maybe trade Bobby Jaques for Salmatation, whatever, Salmonella, whatever you want to call him, the number one catching prospect in baseball, a guy named Escobar. He was a second-round draft pick. He's a Cuban defector. He had 4 hits earlier on this week for the Atlanta Braves, plays shortstop, major need, catcher and shortstop. And then a guy like Joe Devine, a hard-throwing, high draft pick of last year that's being groomed to be a closer as is.
And you're doing this all on the basis that the Sox may not be in it next year, and maybe not the year after. And even if it is the year after, you're talking about relievers of baseball, you're talking about a power pitcher in Bobby Jaques. He might be very, very good right now, and he might be very, very good the rest of the season, and maybe even next year. But there's a possibility that 2-3 years down the line, he's not going to be the same pitcher. So if you could get some good value for him, deal with that closing situation later, because right now the Sox aren't even in closing situations anyway.
Valuable is a closer when you're not necessarily competing? You know, how valuable is that role? I think it's more valuable to first find a starting shortstop and a starting catcher.
And you know what? At any moment, if you throw any team out there and you say, listen, would you rather have, especially if you're in a Sox situation where you have 3 outfield spots and 2 infield spots open, available, would you rather fill a position spot or would you rather fill a closer role? They're going to take that position player spot, pending the quality of the player, of course.
So I really think if the Sox want to go into a rebuilding mode, they should, you know, consider moving Bobby Jaques. And obviously, I think a no-brainer, as much as Jose Contreras is a no-brainer, is Jim Thome. And I know you agree with me on this, because Jim Thome is a bat that is really getting old. He is not the same player he once was, and he's not going to add value to this team the next 1 or 2 years. And he's just going to get worse. He's going to be on the disabled list more and more, and he commands value because a bat like his is the impact bat that we thought Jermaine Dye could have been prior to him getting hurt and kind of having a down year so far. Because Jim Thome, he could be a difference maker. He could be that guy. Mark Burley could be that guy. Bobby Jaques could be that guy. And Jim Thome could be that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Those are 3 guys that you should move, especially Burley, if you can't sign him. Or you can take
Jim Thome right now, I think he's got like a $14 million contract. $7 million is being paid by the Phillies, I believe. $7 million being paid by the White Sox. Even if the White Sox got to say, listen, we'll eat $2 million of the contract. If you trade him to a team and they're essentially paying him $5 million, that's got to be a good deal for them, considering when you just look strictly at the numbers and you look at the here and now. Because if they were to make a trade right now for down the stretch, I'm sure a lot of teams would not mind having Jim Thome in the middle of that lineup.
Especially the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, who need a power bat.
And you brought this up before. They're a pretty athletic team, so adding an old veteran like a Jim Thome into that lineup, it could add a nice presence for him.
It gives him another dimension to go with a great rotation, a strong bullpen, and a fast-as-hell team. That is a fast, young ball club the Angels have. And they got a lot of prospects that could look good, that could fill some needs for the White Sox. Because I think if you're in a rebuilding mode, the best thing you do, you collect as much talent as you can, you plug it in different places, you see what you like, and you move other talent to fill other holes.
Yep.
You just pile in the talent.
You keep half and you trade half.
Yeah. And doing all this, you got to remember, you still have John Gerland and Javier Vasquez. You still have John Danks. You still have Gavin Floyd. You still have some semblance of what could be a decent rotation for another couple of years. It could turn into a very good rotation, especially if you get some other power arms, you know, here or there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have a lot of money freed up to still go out and get veterans, because I think any team needs veterans. But the question is, how ballsy is Ken Williams going to get? Because there are options out there, and you got to be looking at this White Sox team. You got to be unimpressed, and you got to be unimpressed with what could immediately help him in the minor leagues, aside from a guy like Ryan Sweeney and Josh Fields, who has been very impressive. And I look forward. He's about the only reason. Him and John Danks are about the only reason I watch the White Sox right now. And I'd like to see some more guys. Danny Rechar come up. And then Andy Gonzalez. He's not bad to watch, because at least he gives you some type of hope. He gives you, you know, that maybe he could be better. Maybe he could turn into a good utility player that could help the Sox, you know.
Oh, I think he could turn into a very, very good utility player, because like you, I haven't really been watching the Sox, you know, all the time like I always used to. Watching him play, he's an infielder. He was a shortstop, right? And he's doing very, very well in the outfield. He seems like he has nice range. He's got a good arm. He's been playing center field. He looks like a guy. He could be literally a super utility guy. And offensively, yeah, he doesn't have all the tools in the world, but he's got a nice size. He could run pretty well for his size. He's got a decent eye. He takes some pitches. He looks like he knows how to go to the opposite field when he has to. He looks like a pretty decent player. And one thing I'd like for the Sox to see do, especially considering they have so many holes anyway, and they've been doing it anyway, play him for the rest of the year, because no matter what happened, no matter what trades are going to happen, there's going to be a spot for him, whether it's second, short, outfield, wherever. Play him a little bit more. See what he does. If he really busts out and becomes a very good player, well, then, you know what? If you can't fill a position player spot next year, maybe you give him somewhat of a shot. If not, you have yourself a bench player for next year. Now, as far as Josh Fields goes, defensively, I think he's got some work to do. I think when Joe Creedy came up, you see the skills were there. It was just a matter of him getting his positioning down and just kind of get the mental part of the game and the decision-making down. When you look at Josh Fields, it looks like he needs a little bit more work. But what I do like about Fields is that he's got that speed, which Creedy never had. He could play that left field if ever need be. And offensively, it seems like after those first week or two that he was here, he seems like he's relaxed a little bit more. And I think what may have happened for the first 2 weeks, he came up on a struggling ball club that had no offense whatsoever, and I think he was pressing even more so. And I think he was trying to do a lot more than what he's capable of doing and what he should be doing. And I think now he's a little bit more relaxed, and he looks a lot more comfortable at the plate.
And he has an idea when he goes up there. For a young player, he goes up there, he looks at pitches, and he looks like he could be a good middle of the order bat. The only question was whether his long swing can be shortened down a bit, yes, so where he can really turn on those inside pitches and drill them. But there is no doubt the power is there. I mean, you see him, and he will legit, he'll have a bad cut, and the ball still goes deep. You know, those are good hitters when they can do that. If he can finish up some little things and hone some of his skills, because I already think he's actually a pretty decent defensive third baseman. He'll never be Joe Creedy. But he could be an above-average third baseman. Yeah, no. Who is? Who is?
But the thing
but
is,
he could be a better player than Joe.
What he's going to lose on that defensive side, he's going to add in the offense because he does have that speed. And I think right now in his career offensively, I think he's on a better pace than Joe Creedy was. And like I said, because of that speed, he could run a little bit. It adds a different dimension to the Sox team that they've lacked this year.
You mean they could go from first to third on a single?
It's a possibility.
Whoa, I didn't know they could do that in baseball.
I think he could do it. I think he could actually do it.
I think only Pacetic and Andy Gonzalez are capable of that on the starting lineup.
Well, Terrell can. By the way, Terrell is as frustrating as he could be offensively because he seems like he takes those big hats. He's fun to watch when he runs because he gives it his all. And
he's not the most brilliant guy in the shed, though, when he's on
the
base.
No, he's definitely not a very smart guy, and that shows because he's got all the tools in the world. He's got the power, he's got the speed, he's got the arm, he's got the range, but he is still a pretty fun player to watch. Now, I wouldn't want to watch him every day as a starter, especially depending what your talent is around him, but he's kind of fun to watch every once in a while, and I think he could be a good fourth outfielder, although next year what I'd like to see is I'd like to see Ryan Sweeney on this team as a fourth outfielder. So we'll kind of see how that goes. It seems like the Sox are filled with a lot of bench players, and two bench players who probably should not be on this team next year. And it's not really because they're bad, but I just think because you're dealing with bench players, I think they got to get some young guys in, is Rob Mikhovyak and Alex Cintron.
Alex Cintron is bad. This season he's been bad.
He's been bad this season. There's no doubt about it. You know what? Yeah, Rob Mikhovyak has been bad too, but I think if you were to keep them next year, I think they would produce because I think they produce in their career. But I think they're two guys you might want to part ways with, get some young guys off that bench.
Yeah, I think they're guys that, especially in Mikhoviak's case, you may be able to get a lower-level prospect for right now at the trade deadline, and it's kind of a no-brainer. Why not make the move?
To a National League team, yeah.
Because he can help. I mean, I'd want him on my bench if I was a National League team in the playoffs. You gotta be kidding me, because he's a better player than he's been hitting right now. And the White Sox case, it doesn't make sense to pay this guy $3.2
million. No. Before this season, last couple of years, you could say, you know what? They have a lot of starting positions set, so if you give a guy like Alex Cintron and Rob Mikhoviak some money to be bench players and be very good bench players, because when you look at 2005, when you look at last year, Rob Mikhoviak and Alex Cintron were very good bench players and probably two of the better bench players in the majors. So when you give $2, $3 million to them, it's acceptable. But when your position players, when your starters are so depleted like the Sox have right now, Rob Mikhoviak and Alex Cintron doesn't seem like there's much sense in having them.
And I want to kind of finish this segment up.
Bulls.
Before we go talk about the Bulls and the draft, because I want to have a little short generic segment of the Bulls. But Scott Pesenik, I'm actually happy to see him back up here because he at least is trying. And I thought his quotes were very telling when he said, this team is dead. This is a different team in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
And then I've seen from some inside type of sources posted on Sox Talk. None of my sources, I don't know anything about this, is, and I don't really have many sources. I have a couple. I know very little about very little, for the most part, aside from what I read and reading in between the lines of stuff. But it's kind of the fact that this team would rather drink and drink beers than really go play baseball. They really don't care. And you can kind of see it by watching them play. Because this is a veteran team making rookie mistakes.
You saw this July of last year. I mean, it's been going on since July of last year, and the players talked all they want about them trying, and it's pretty clear that that a lot of these guys aren't, and that's why it's somewhat fun to see guys like Torreira and Gonzalez and Fields, because you know that they're actually trying to play, and they're actually trying to hustle and to try to get to third base when they're starting at first on a single. They're actually trying to do something else rather than just kind of go from base to base and take their hacks and go to the bench, collect their paycheck, then go out drinking on that very night. So, yeah, and it might be, and it was really nice to see Scott Pezenek kind of speak up and say that this team has no life, because they don't. And really, Scott Pezenek has been, it's pretty fun to watch. I mean, he's not the most talented hitter, so he's going to go through his slumps. But when he came up, he did instill a little bit of life into this team. And considering he really didn't make many stolen base attempts, he seems like he's a little bit more aggressive. So it is nice to see him, and I think as long as he keeps going, he might be able to net you some decent minor league player who could turn into, you never know.
I do think Pasenik, if he can play good for the next 3 weeks, could actually end up getting the Sox something of value. Because
if he's healthy,
how often can you get a leadoff guy this late in the season?
Even if it's a National League team that's just looking for someone to come off the bench late in the innings, he wouldn't be a bad guy to get. Now, obviously, he's not the typical guy because he's not much of a defensive player, but even then, if he shows that he's healthy, and when he's healthy, he steals bases at will, he could be a productive player for some teams, and he can net you a fringe AAA guy. And you know what? One thing Kenny Williams has done a decent job of in his tenure with the Sox is get those fringe players. Get those AAA players who aren't quite good or aren't quite known or at least thought highly of, and make them into decent major league players.
Well, I think what Ken Williams targets is guys that are good in terms of scout numbers, you know, scout stuff,
yeah,
abilities and tools, and maybe they don't have the production, maybe they've had the falling out, and he tries to go get those guys. And I think maybe you could do that with Pasenik.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you're going to get a can't-miss prospect for him.
But you could get someone who could maybe turn into something. It's... You look at the team, a guy like Juan Uribe, that's what type of trade was. It was a team like the Rockies, who really didn't want him. It was a falling out. The Sox get him, and he's not the greatest player in the world, but he was productive for the Sox, and he helped that 2005 team immensely. So there's always trades like that you can make that you can kind of get that fringe player. You know, Torreira's another example. Granted, he hasn't produced, but he's a guy you get from, I believe, the Diamondbacks he was on.
Baltimore Orioles.
He was on the Orioles. He started with the Diamondbacks, though. He originally was on the Diamondbacks. I think he went to the Baltimore Orioles. I think he was released. The Sox get him. He has all the tools. Maybe something happens. If it doesn't, big thing, because you didn't really give up much for him anyway.
Yeah. And then Darren Erstad, if he could get back healthy, is another guy that could help.
A good bench player.
No, I'm not saying you get anything, but why wouldn't a team have interest in a guy like Darren Erstad? It's been a pretty proven winner. And I know the stat people out there are going to be like, oh, he said the term winner, clutch, grinder. Oh, that's bullshit. But you know what? In the end, you should ask the team people that play with Darren Erstad, and they all know baseball. They all play the game, and they all say he makes your team better.
August, so you know what? September, October, if you have a guy like Darren Erstad on your team who is just a flat-out hustler, and he's been through the playoffs before, he was with an Angels team that was productive, and they were competitive every single year, you got to be pretty confident that he could be, maybe not a starter, but he could be productive, you know, every other day or so.
Yeah, and teams trade for those type of guys. Teams could use that type of veteran's leadership or that veteran spark off the bench. Could be helpful.
The thing is, a lot of people look at Darren Erstad or Scott Pezenek or Rob McCovey and they say, oh, well, you can't get anything for him. You could get something for him. It may not be a guy who's going to be an all-star or Hall of Famer or a guy you could even put into the starting lineup right now, but you could get someone who maybe has some type of ability to help this team to some capacity. Because it is a 25-man roster, and you do have to fill those roster spots. So if you could make a trade a Pasenik or a trade Erstad, you could get a decent little AAA player. Maybe he turns into something. You never know.
Yeah, most likely you're talking to A-ball players they're going to get. But maybe it's a guy in A-ball that throws 95 mile an hour, has an ERA over 5. You don't know what could happen in his development. Mm-hmm. He's probably 19, 20 years old. You don't know.
You never know. You never know.
It's gonna happen.
And the Sox have known. Once again, the Sox are pretty bad at developing their own talent, it seems, but they seem to be pretty good at getting guys from other organizations and tweaking with them a little bit to make them into solid ball players. You look at a guy like Evan Floyd, came from the Phillies, and it looks like he's in AAA right now, and he's producing. I think he's, what, his last 5-6 starts, he's been very, very impressive, at least from the numbers standpoint. What?
I'm just watching the Sox game. I hate to interrupt.
I thought you were laughing at what I said. I'm like, Gavin Floyd has been doing well, hasn't he?
I can back up on Gavin Floyd, and I would go right into Floyd after this. But Luis Torero was up, and he just swung, and he swung through it and flipped the bat around. The bat went flying right in between the catcher and umpire on a pop-out he made.
See, the Sox are fun to watch. Who said they're not fun to watch? That's entertainment. That's what they should do. They should just do stupid shit like that every game and make people watch them.
I get thrown out at third base like 2 times in an inning. Yeah, they're good at that.
Well, no, not the ugly playing, but like just do goofy things, you know? Start fights. Fights are always fun. Fans love watching fights. They could do that a couple times a game.
But Gavin Floyd is a good example. And you're not going to get a Gavin Floyd type of talent, at least from the AAA level, you know, for a guy like Scott Pacetti.
No.
He's a good example of the type of guys you target.
You know,
maybe you have a guy that's, you know.
The thing is, if there's a guy who's a notch below Gavin Floyd from a talent level, that guy could very well go into the bullpen and be a very productive reliever for you for one season. That's the thing. I mean, bullpens are so important nowadays, but they're so much of a crapshoot. You could get a guy with a 5-year ERA in AA, and he could produce one good season for you in the bullpen, and that's maybe all you need because that might lead you to the championship. So there's always a possibility there with any trades that you can make.
Well, look at guys, for example, the Sox have given up. John Roush is the Gary Majeskis of the world. They weren't very highly thought of. Well, John Roush was once highly thought of before he had injury. I mean, that guy could have been a star. But 4 or 5 years down the road when they were traded, you know, he wasn't highly thought of. Majeski wasn't. But Majeski, he's had arm problems and he's struggled this, you know, I don't even think he's pitched this year. But, you know, he's had some talent. You know, he's had some success. And both those guys have pitched well out of bullpens. Royce Ring's pitching good in the bullpen, you know, out of the pen. Bobby Harry kind of, you know, had his ups with the major league team, went away, came back. You know, there's always those type of smaller deals you can make that you can go with. Bobby Harry's a bad example because he was a major league player. I'm talking minor leaguers, but
either
way, you guys get the gist. It's a possibility, and I'm hoping we're going to see a lot of changes. And every show we talk about, we may be talking about new faces that are coming up, and it should be exciting. I'm hoping we'll be able to have like a new level of excitement because I know, speaking of Mario, and I know myself, we like to see this development. It's going to be a change. And it's going
to
suck not winning quite as much.
But it's still fun
to
watch.
But it's going to be the only way to get back up to a 90-win season. You got to go back and you got to get some type of development up here. And whether Ken Williams wants to call it retooling or rebuilding, you got to get an influx of some athletes and some talent and some fresh faces because you got to create some energy and some life to this team and get some guys that want to come in and win and hustle and do the little things and play baseball and play hard.
110% you are. You're right. Dead on.
So we're going to be back talking about the hustle that the Chicago Bulls added in the draft, maybe some other random shit in a short third segment. Because we know that you, the listener, wanted to hear us the last couple of weeks
it
to the month.
Makes
because
it harder for
how
me,
else
it?
Could you get through this season that's been so bad? But listen to the greatness that is the Southside Baseball Report. And we're going to do our best to continue to provide excellent podcast, radio, whatever you want to call it.
Killing
and we're
going
to call it excellent even if you
killing
won't. Because we are excellent people.
One
so we'll be back in a minute.
Too much. And we're back. Southside Report. Talking White Sox, no more. Third segment. This is the third segment that Jason had to throw in me last minute. I was thinking we're doing a one-segment show, then he's got to throw in. No, we're doing 2 segments. Now we're going to do 3 segments. And, of course, because he tells you, the audience, I'm forced to do it. But we're going to talk about the Chicago Bulls. They had a draft this Thursday, and they drafted Joakim Noah with their first-round pick.
It was a real shocker, wasn't it, Mario? Last year, who did the Bulls have number one on their draft board? Joakim Noah. He opted out. He didn't end up going into the draft. Bulls took Tyrus Thomas. Yes, you can make a case that they're similar players, but Joakim Noah has a little bit more height. He could be a true center in this NBA. He could be 3 years down the road replacing Ben Wallace, because they, you know, there's a little bit of Ben Wallace in Joakim Noah. Hopefully there's more offensive ability than what Ben Wallace has. But Joakim Noah brings attitude, he brings leadership, he can win, and he is a very good athlete at 7 feet. Now, I'm not to say that I guarantee he's going to turn into a legitimate offensive player, but he has at least a decent free throw percentage. He can shoot the free throw, and he's got some touch. He can dunk around the basket, and maybe we can teach him, you know, a little bit of a hook shot, some type of jumper for mid-range game.
So,
you know, they can turn him into a player.
Even if he's not a star, he could be potentially in that starting lineup as a fifth guy in that lineup and just be a productive, whether defensive player, whatever the case may be. He could be a productive NBA player, but do you think he could produce off the bat next season? I mean, you look at Tyrus Thomas, it took him maybe halfway through the season before he really started getting on the court and being a productive player for the Bulls. How long will it take before Joakim Noah is producing for the Bulls, even off the bench?
He will get significant minutes immediately with the Chicago Bulls. He's had 3 years in college, 3 years at a major conference, 3 years of tournament experience, 2 years of national championship experience, and he has always been in the limelight. He's always been the guy they talk about when they talk about the University of Florida's basketball team. It's always been Joakim Noah. Al Horford is a better pro project. Corey Brewer is a very good pro project. Torin Green, less so, but he's going to be a decent major leaguer. Wow, what a play by Josh Fields. Diving to play over at third base. He's made two phenomenal plays today. He's playing good. Sox are winning 1-0 in the seventh now with one out. Little play-by-play, even though it's going to be up long after the game's over with and the bullpen blows it. But that's beside the point. And Noah's handled the pressure. And he's going to come in, and he's immediately going to be able to play defense. He's going to be a very good defensive player. And he's going to be an impact, high-energy guy that can run the court. And let's be honest, Spencer Hawes was the other option. And I like Spencer Hawes. I think he's going to be a good NBA player. But I question whether Spencer Hawes fits the Bulls system. The Bulls, at their best, play great defense, and they get out on transition, and they run. I don't think Spencer Hawes is the type of guy that can run. Yes, the Bulls need a low-post player for when they're in that half-court game, but that low-post player should also be a guy that can move when they are in the transition situations. Ben Wallace can run. Tyrus Thomas made such an impact because he could move down the court. He'd block a dunk, and he blocks a shot on one end, and he'd be down for the dunk on the other end. And those are the type of guys that the Bulls like to have, and they fit into the Scottsdale system. And these are the type of character individuals the Bulls like to have. And Noah brings that cocky swagger that the Bulls really lack. Now, maybe it could get misconstrued, because Cade McNown had some cocky swagger that I thought would be good for the Chicago Bears. It wasn't. I've been wrong before.
I think you touched it in the beginning when you talked about winners, because it seems like Paxton has that history through the draft of getting guys who have won, who have been productive college players and been a winning team. So what are you laughing at now?
So I said the Sox are winning 1-0. Next pitch, home run.
I keep thinking you're laughing at me. I'm like, what am I saying wrong? I'm like, the Bulls have drafted typical winners, right?
Yeah, that's the Bulls' MO. And how can you doubt John Paxton? What he's done since taking over for Jerry Cross. He's turned him into a 49-win team. And this is a team that's going to be perennially knocking on the championship door, especially when they add a big man. And Joakim Noah is not the answer as the low post scorer. John Paxton's been the first to admit it. And there's no guarantee that Joakim Noah stays in Chicago. I happen to think, and I'm 100% positive of this, that Kobe Bryant of the greater Los Angeles area is going to be wearing a uniform in Chicago. And when his career is done, there will be a statue of Michael Jordan, his airness, his greatness, and Kobe Bryant next to each other, and Kobe Bryant's statue will have 7 rings. 7. 3 with the Lakers, 7, the only 7 we're going to put on his hand are the ones we got from the Bulls, and a total of 10 in his NBA career. If he makes the Bryant move, puts the bullet in the gun, and puts it to Mitch Kupchak, the Lakers GM, Lakers owner Jerry Buss, and says, hey, I ain't playing here. I will never play again for the Lakers. Now, you get me to a situation because you, the Lakers organization, lied to me. I came here because it was going to be competitive. Otherwise, I would have signed with Chicago as is, or signed with the Los Angeles Clippers because he wanted to go to those places. But Jerry Buss made a promise to him that he is not he's not fulfilled. And then, boom, Kobe Bryant comes in, Bulls win championships, even without that low post score. That's what probably is going to happen. I hear silence. You're amazed at my greatness. the great, what was it, the psychic Chloe, what was her name? The great Chloe told me that Kobe Bryant is coming to the Bulls. I paid $20 a minute to hear that. So I'm going to back it. I already bought a Bulls jersey with the number 24
forced,
on it.
You and forced, shut up, you forced the third segment so you could get into a Kobe Bryant's coming to the Bulls is going to win seven champions. Are you kidding? Can you just relax a little bit? Seven championships? Seven? Not only are you making a prediction on something that has very little chance of happening, but then you're going to go out there and say seven championships? You are a very optimistic person today. Very optimistic. And this coming from a person who is absolutely bitching at the beginning of the show for the handling of Mr. Mark Burley. So, man, have you been all over the map. Just relax.
And I wanted to
try to get a little even keel, please.
Well, I'm going to get a little bit more even keel because I'm going to talk about the rest of the Bulls draft picks. You took Aaron Gray, the big man, and I'm not a big fan of him because I don't like unathletic basketball players. I don't. I think you want athletes.
But sometimes big guys clog the middle just enough.
Yeah, and Gray can do that. Gray kind of has similar tools to Spencer Hawes, but he's not near as good as a player as Spencer Hawes because Spencer Hawes has a lot of offensive game and a lot of offensive tools. Gray doesn't have quite that much, but Gray's a good rebounder. He gives a good body for the Bulls, and at least he gives the Bulls sides because Joakim Noah and Aaron Gray both are over 7 feet, and one of the problems they had with Detroit was the fact that Detroit's longer bigs got over the Bulls and out-rebounded the Bulls in the games the Bulls struggled in, and the Bulls cannot afford to have that happen again, and they're going to make sure of that by getting these two guys. But they also took a guy named James On Curry. Never heard of the name James On. I don't know what the hell it means. The guy's a pot dealer. The guy busted many a time in high school, but he's made some changes. This is a guy that was recruited by Coach Roy Williams in North Carolina, got that scholarship rescinded, ended up going to Oklahoma State, and he's a scorer. He's going to replace Chris Duhon. Probably won't play point guard, but this is a guy that if Ben Gordon is traded, this is the reason why he's expendable, because Ben Gordon adds not only some scoring, but Ben Gordon is the outside shooter. Yes, Andres Nocioni can shoot the three. Yes, Kirk Heinrich can shoot the three, but no one is as explosive as Ben Gordon with the three ball. But James On Curry is an explosive shooter. He can hit the three. He can hit a two. He's a scorer. He's not a great defensive player. He's a good athlete, not an amazing athlete. Ben Gordon's not an amazing athlete, but he's a natural scorer who should help the Bulls off the bench, because the Bulls lacked scoring off the bench after Nocioni had his plantar fasciitis, whatever you want to call it, plantar fasciitis, whatever the foot injury was. And you also have to realize that there's a good chance Andre Nocioni is going to be gone, because as much as Chicago loves Andre Nocioni, as much as management and the coaching staff loves Andre Nocioni, the reality is Luol Deng is a starting small forward. And Nocioni is kind of a three or a four, but the Bulls don't really have a spot for him. And yes, he's great. It's great to have him come off the bench, but for $6 or $7 million, you could use that to get yourself a big. And I think that's going to be the reality. They're going to make that move. They're going to try to get a Paul Gasol in a deal potentially involving Ben Gordon and Nocioni, and then use their mid-level exemption of $6 or $6.5 million to find a guard. Because there's going to be guards out there. They're going to come to a team that's a piece away from it. Well, they just got their big.
They're not going to need any guards. They're going to have Kobe Bryant. So you're going to have Kobe Bryant, Paul Gasol, and you'll be good to go.
Yeah, good to go. No, we cannot get both of them. We're going to get Kevin Garnett and Kobe Bryant. I kid when I say that. The Bulls actually have the ability to do it, but the team wouldn't have much else around it. And then we're going to kind of go from the positives of the Bulls, because you got to really like the fact that this is a young team, and even if they don't win the championship, and I realize that's the ultimate goal, this is a fun team to watch because of how good character guys these are. They play the game. And then you have Tank Johnson. Tank D-U-Y Johnson. The Bears stepped up to their principles, and they released him, and it was a good call. It's a very good decision. I feel bad for Tank Johnson. I think he's a man that made a lot of mistakes. He may be misunderstood. I don't think he's a bad guy. I don't think he's a Pac-Man Jones. I don't think he's a Ray Caruth. I don't think he's, you know, a total loser of a person. He's just a guy that made some mistakes. But the reality is when you make that many mistakes, you get caught that many times, you're going to pay for him. And the Bears ownership had to draw the line somewhere and stand up, something the Cincinnati Bengals should take a look at, because it's a joke that they haven't taken care of all their jailbirds that they have. So that's a wrap, unless Mario wants to make it a fourth segment show where we talk about how stupid he is and how right I am about those seven championships that Kobe Bryant will win. So nothing out of Mario.
I can imagine the reaction a Bulls fan gives you when you bring that up, because I'm sure, knowing you, that you have brought up this Kobe Bryant is going to be on the Bulls before, whether it was on a message board, whether it was in person with someone. I am sure you have brought this up before. And I'm sure you have made the 7 championship prediction before. So I would love to see the reaction that you have gotten from those statements.
Well, the 7 championship reaction, this is the public airing of that. But the
Great.
After the draft, I made a guarantee on TalkBulls.com. You people listening? TalkBulls.com. www.talkbulls.com. Go talk about my predictions. Go talk about the Bulls. Go talk about the draft. Maybe they're going to get a guy like Nick Collison. Maybe they're going to get a guy like Drew Gooden. Maybe they go Paul Gasol. Maybe they go Kevin Garnett. Maybe they go Amari Stoudemire. Maybe they go Kobe Bryant. You can talk how baseless and nameless and useless my predictions are, but get your ass over to Talk Bulls, because there I made a prediction that Kobe Bryant would be there, and I guaranteed anyone. I said that I made a sig bet. And I don't know if you know what a sig bet is, but I made a sig bet saying if the Bulls don't have Kobe Bryant in their lineup or on their roster on opening day, I could, whatever people wanted in my signature, they could put in there. But if I'm right, they would call both me and a poster named W. Harris 1, Willie Harris, post on Sox Talk, moderator on Talk Bulls. We both agree that Kobe Bryant's going to be in that Bulls uniform, and we know it. So you know what, you all? We're going to have the final laugh, and we're going to have a sink that says how everyone else on the entire board is going to have a signature that says no one is as great as W. Harris and Chai Sox fan. That's that. And I should just keep talking because it's going to piss Mario off. What else?
Falling asleep, man.
So yeah, talk
Bears.
You're
like a teenage girl. You won't stop talking.
Oh! You know what we didn't talk about yet? The Chicago Blackhawks draft, people. Patrick Kane. God. That's all I know about, and we're calling the show because I don't talk hockey.
I know. Man, it's like you're going to make the effort to talk to Blackhawks.
Mario's going to give us his extra analyst in his own show on 360 The Pitch. .com, where he's going to talk about Patrick Kane and how he's never going to want to do a podcast ever again with me. So that's a wrap, people. We hope you enjoyed the show. As always, send questions, feedback, or whatever the hell you have over at theboards@soxtalk.com or in an email to contact@futuresox.com. Thanks for listening to Southside Baseball Report, and we are out.